The name of our podcast, Tech Sequences, is really a mashup of two words, technology and consequences. We are fascinated by the consequences, intended or unintended, of the internet and related technologies for the way we live, play, and work. We are your hosts, Leslie Daigle and Alexa Rod. We started our careers at the dawn of the internet and have been friends, colleagues, and comrades in arms for the better part of 20 years. In this podcast, we examine the impact internet-related technologies have made or may make in our lives. I'm Alexa Rod.
And I'm Leslie Daigle.
Welcome to Tech Sequences. Transistor, radio, television, laser, wireless technology, automobiles, airplanes, computers, nuclear fission, manned spaceflight, quantum computing, and the internet are just some of the few breakthroughs, innovations of the 20th century. The century credited as being one of the most, if not the most innovative one in mankind's time on Earth. These inventions changed our lives for the better, making the world smaller and information and economic opportunities more accessible. Many of history's most glorious technology innovations were rooted in the art of the possible, their later application and use unconstrained by what it was originally designed for. For example, blockchain, invented by Stuart Haber and Scott Stornetta, was originally intended as a tool to timestamp digital documents. We now associate it with Bitcoin because in 2009, the creator or creators of Bitcoin, known under the pseudonym Satoshi Nakamoto, repurposed the technology into a decentralized cryptocurrency. Just as it was hard to predict the unconventional way blockchain would be applied, it is also hard to predict the potential consequences of a technology, even when it is used just as intended. However, that has not stopped pundits from making predictions about a given technology's impact and or its consequences. Some of those predictions are eerily accurate, while others turn out to be false, and a few egregiously so. Take the internet, for example. In 1995, the same year that Microsoft released Internet Explorer 2 to compete head-to-head with Netscape, Robert Metcalfe, the inventor of the Ethernet cable, said, quote, "I predict the internet will go spectacularly supernova, and in 1996, catastrophically will collapse," unquote. The same year, astronomer Clifford Stoll, the author of the book, The Cuckoo's Egg, dampened expectations of the internet's ubiquity and use by saying, quote, "The truth is no online database will replace your daily newspaper, no CD-ROM can take the place of a competent teacher, and no computer network will change the way government works," unquote. Both were, of course, spectacularly wrong. A few years later, in 1998, the RAND Corporation published a paper titled The Information Age and the Printing Press by James Dewar. The paper sought to describe the information age and foreshadow where it may lead. Keep in mind, back then, only about 20 million computers worldwide were linked to the internet, compared to, say, over 20 billion today. Dewar stipulated that it would be decades before the full impact of the information age is understood, and that its future will be dominated by unintended consequences. Although we are barely two decades in, the 21st century has already delivered innovations such as social media, 3D printing, augmented and virtual reality, cryptocurrency, self-driving cars, and other technologies yet to be invented. What impact will these technologies make in our lives? What have we learned? And are we now better equipped to fathom the unintended consequences of their use?
Our guest today is Vint Cerf, widely known as the father of the internet. Vint is the co-designer of the TCP/IP protocols and the architecture of the internet. Vint began his work at the United States Department of Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, DARPA, playing a key role in leading the development of internet and internet-related data packet and security technologies. In 1998, Vint was instrumental in establishing ICANN, the Internet Corporation for Assigned Names and Numbers, responsible for the coordination and maintenance of the internet's namespace and IP address space. He joined the board of ICANN in 1999 and served until November 2007. Since 2005, he has served as vice president and chief internet evangelist for Google. In this role, he's responsible for identifying new enabling technologies to support the development of advanced internet-based products and services. The recipient of numerous awards and honors, Vint has been recognized for his contributions to science and technology, including the Turing Award, Marconi Prize, Queen Elizabeth Prize for Engineering, the National Medal of Technology, the IEEE Alexander Graham Bell Award, and the Presidential Medal of Freedom, the nation's highest civilian honor. Welcome, Vint.
Well, thank you so much. First of all, I'm not the only father of the internet. And as everyone knows, if you want to do anything big, yeah, the first rule is get some help, preferably from people who are smarter than you are. Bob Kahn really started the project while he was at DARPA in late 1972. And we began collaborating on this in the spring of 1973. And of course, since that time, both of you and many, many others have contributed enormously to internet success. And also let me blame you a little bit for some of the problems that it has, which have emerged out of the technology in ways that I think we either didn't imagine or hope wouldn't arise. But we've discovered that people are people, and there's not a whole lot we can do about that.
Indeed. So Alexa outlined a number of spectacularly wrong predictions of the future of the internet. But what were your expectations, both at the time of, you know, its inception, if you will, and then maybe in the mid-1990s when the internet was clearly getting beyond a research-funded project?
Well, first of all, you should appreciate the project was started by the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency for a particular purpose, which was to support command and control, particularly the use of computers in that endeavor. And Bob and I knew that if we were really going to use computers for command and control, that we would have to support voice, video, and data as part of the command and control system. So very early on in the design of the internet, there was consideration for all three of those technologies or capabilities. Our purpose at the time was just to get the thing to work, to figure out what the protocols were. We had a cadre of mostly graduate students, all of whom were interested in getting this to work and in flushing out mistakes that we had made in protocol design. For all practical purposes, nobody was thinking, how do I wreck this thing? Although from a purely defensive point of view, we were well aware that we'd have to build a system that would be resistant to various kinds of attack. And that included encryption. And a lot of people have asserted that somehow security was ignored. That's not true. I started working very closely with NSA in 1975, before the internet, you know, became implemented, in order to develop packet crypto, for example, as opposed to link level crypto. Public key cryptography wasn't really the concept wasn't invented until 1976 with the paper that Whitdiffy and Marty Hellman published out of Stanford. Although GCHQ in the UK actually had invented the idea in 1974, they chose not to make it public for maybe obvious reasons. But it wasn't available as an implemented capability until later. And by that time, I was running the program. It's 1978. I'm trying to freeze the protocols so we can get them implemented on as many operating systems as possible so I can actually try it out on the then ARPANET plus the packet radio net plus the packet satellite net. So I was very focused, as were my colleagues, on just getting this thing to work and to create a flexible platform that could evolve over time, whether that meant adding new protocols in the vertical space or adding protocols horizontally in order to explore and exploit new possibilities and capabilities. We were testing packet voice and packet video in the late 70s and early 80s, although not very much of it because our data rates that were available were very low. 50 kilobits a second was the backbone of the ARPANET, 128 kilobits on the satellite network, and somewhere between 100 and 400 kilobits on the mobile packet radio net. So those early years were all about just trying to get the protocol right and trying to get the implementations done. We turned the system on in January of 1983, and then I left to go into the private sector to build something called MCI Mail. And during that period from 83 to, say, 86 or so, John Postel and Paul Makapetris at USC Information Sciences Institute went ahead to invent the domain name system. And so I made no claims about any of that work. That was their wonderful invention. And then I rejoined my partner, Bob Kahn, at CNRI, the Corporation for National Research Initiatives, and we started working on applications, and I got drawn back into the standards effort, the Internet Architecture Board, the IETF, and the Internet Research Task Force. So what were we thinking? Well, Bob and I were thinking, after the initial implementation and demonstration of the system and turning it on in January of 83, when we got back together again, we started thinking about what kinds of applications might be feasible in this growing distributed environment. We were particularly interested in digital information, digital libraries, and the possibility of mobile software moving around in the network. We called them knowledge robots.
Agents.
And we even implemented a sort of a prototype of that idea. I would submit, you know, leaping far forward for just a second, that when you think about the World Wide Web and the way it actually works, there is mobile software, because what happens when you go to a website is you download a piece of HTML, which at this stage of the game with HTML5 is a programming language. It's, as far as I can remember, it is a Turing complete language. And so you ingest this thing and then you execute it within a browser, which is for all practical purposes an operating system. So we do have mobile software moving around in the net today, but just not quite the kind that we envisioned at the time. I would say that during the mid to late 1980s, I was still very focused on the Defense Department application space, except that we could see commercialization coming. The interop conventions, for example, exhibitions were demonstrating all kinds of applications that were in the sort of the public sector. And around 1988, I was beginning to wonder, how do we get the general public access to the internet? And so I began pushing very hard to build a commercial engine that would support internet growth and expansion. And I got a lot of feedback, negative feedback, from people who had been working on this for a long time. Why would you let this unwashed general public into our sandbox? And my reaction was, look, we've already learned it's a very powerful, useful tool. This is before the web and before search engines. It was still evident that it was quite useful. And I said I wanted to let the general public in on this. So we struggled for a while. But by 1989, we started to see commercial internet services. So for some people, the internet sort of arrives like under a cabbage leaf. It's all there. For people like me, it starts out, you know, as a project. And over time, you begin to realize that it's useful for a variety of things that had not been anticipated. So today, of course, you watch the consequences of the World Wide Web arriving, an avalanche of content flowing in because everybody wants to share their information, sudden need for search engines to find anything in this morass of content, followed by the arrival of the smartphone in 2007. And each of those milestones, anyway, triggered a significant increase in use and scope of application. The smartphones are really quite a remarkable idea. You wonder, how did Steve Jobs recognize the utility of that particular combination? A camera, radios for transmission and reception, phone calls, access to the internet, ability to run an application in the mobile itself. So what happens is the smartphone makes the internet more accessible, because no matter where you are, you've got access to it, assuming you can get a signal. And second, the internet makes the mobile phone or the smartphone more useful because of all the applications on the net. And so I would say that in that period of time, the mid-2000s, that was a very significant inflection point. And I think we'd also, if we look back in time, we'd see that the social media are starting to emerge at that point as well. And of course, they're utility is exacerbated by the fact that you can take pictures and movies and record sound and the like, and as well as, you know, sending text messages and other things. At this stage of the game, looking at this from 2021, through the lens of the pandemic, it's very clear that this tool is being exercised to do things that we only dreamed about, if we did dream about them at all. And the ability to work from home, which is where I am right now, I'm in my basement, and I've been in the basement for the last 2.5 years, all practical purposes. It also highlighted the fact that not everyone can work away, or can work remotely. Not all jobs allow that. You could see supply chain fragility. You could see disparities in people's ability to work remotely or not. You could see the pressure coming from the educational system, trying to have school children go to school remotely in a way that had never been really attempted before, with very, very mixed results. I will tell you one thing, a very interesting discovery, a personal discovery, is that after 2 years or so of doing this sort of video conferencing to work, I finally was able to go back into my office and see people face to face. And the first thing I discovered is that people are three-dimensional. And the second thing, the more important thing I discovered, is that I could get up and walk around while I was having a conversation with someone. You can't do that in this setting, because if you do, you disappear off the screen. Right. And you're a disembodied voice, and it's very disconcerting. So actually working with people face-to-face has this benefit of freedom to move around. And I hadn't realized how confining it was to sit in front of the camera until I went back and had face-to-face conversations. I realized that one huge thing that I didn't mention that is equally important from the technical point of view is the arrival of multi-layer neural networks. The whole notion of a neural network had been discounted in the 1960s, in particular a book by Seymour Papert and Marvin Minsky called Perceptrons, which basically said a one-layer neural network doesn't do very much, so don't bother pursuing that. But so that was the sort of a winter of artificial intelligence. But there were a few people who stuck with it. And at the point where you could do hundreds of layers of neural networks, suddenly everything is different. It's like a lot of other things. When you get past a certain scale, suddenly you're in new parametric territory. So the introduction of machine learning at scale has really made a dramatic difference. And I think we're still trying to understand the strengths and weaknesses of that capability.
In fact, I should have actually mentioned that as one of the key technologies. So Vint, you've actually watched the internet from its infancy, like as a fetus, right? All the way to now. And it was born at a time when there was so much optimism about globalization. You know, the Berlin Wall had come down. There were a lot of talk about the lowering of trade barriers. It was the age of NAFTA. And the idea of cooperation globally, that was going to make things ultimately better. And the internet is effectively the perfect case example of interconnectedness, global interconnectedness. Now we see that whole idea, and the internet is a little bit under assault by governments, by special interests, for example. Where, if you are, you know, as a co-father of the internet, who worries about their children, what are you worried about when you're looking at the internet and some of the forces that are trying to push it one way or another?
Well, keep in mind that there were two, I'm sure there were many more than two, but two particular streams of evolution for the internet. The first one, of course, is that it was being designed and built initially as the command and control platform for the Defense Department, and by extension, allies as well. Which is, by the way, the reason that Bob and I released the design publicly in one way is that we didn't know who our allies were going to be 25 years later. And so we decided everybody needed to have knowledge of how to build this stuff. So there was that angle, the Defense Department angle. But the other one is that it was born in academia, in the research world. And there, collaboration is the norm. People work together in order to achieve new results. And ARPA encouraged that strongly. So we started out with this collaborative, collegial view, which extended internationally with the International Network Working Group. And for many, many years, that was the primary motivator and atmosphere in which the work was done. Once it becomes commercially available, and once businesses are starting to form around that technology, now there's money involved. And as soon as money is involved, you start seeing different kinds of motivations. Companies that are dependent on and making use of internet for their business have a certain perspective, which is to, you know, to stake out their territory and maximize the value to the company. So that's one trend. The commercialization trend leads to a set of views and motivations. And the second thing that happens, of course, is that the global nature of the system, the fact that it's insensitive to national boundaries, the fact that everything is connected to everything by design. The intent was that any device on any of the nets of the internet should be able to communicate with any other device on any other net, because we didn't know at the time what the applications were going to be and what devices needed to talk to each other. So this ubiquity of connectivity also means ubiquity of attack surface, maybe thinking about the defense. The second thing is that as you start designing and building applications around the belief that there is this full connectivity, then you create dependencies. And as soon as you create these global dependencies, when they don't work, if for some reason they get disrupted, all kinds of things don't work. Understanding what is dependent on what else and how effective they would be if that which you were dependent on isn't working is a really important thing to take into account. And I will cite the smartphone as a really good example of that. This environment is so rich in possibility that we have literally millions of applications that have been built for the smartphone. And we pile on all these things and assume everybody has one and it's working, but you have access to a signal and the battery isn't dead and you've downloaded the appropriate apps. When that doesn't work, when that assumption doesn't work, it's amazing how cascade failures arise out of that assumption of functionality and the presence of dependency. So at this point, I'm very worried about the potential hazards of dependency, for one thing. Second, I'm worried about the assumption that you have a particular device, in this case, a smartphone. What I would really like is that all of the various internet-enabled devices, whether it's a pad or a tablet or a smartphone or something, all can perform similar functions, so that if one of them doesn't work, the other one can be used as a backup.
Like a backup.
We don't have that philosophy built into a lot of the application designs that we have today. The second thing I would observe and that worries me about the current atmosphere that we're in is that now that we understand how abusive people will choose to use the internet and its amplification capability to do harmful things, whether it's spam or phishing or denial of service attacks or propagation of malware or ransomware or bullying or any of a variety of bad behaviors, we now have to figure out how to cope with that. And countries recognize this, administrations recognize this, and they have different reactions to it, depending on what is of primacy to them. So as an example, the Chinese are concerned that their citizens might get access to stuff outside of China that they don't want them to have access to. The Russians have similar views, and other totalitarian or authoritarian states are similarly worried about protecting the regime as opposed to protecting the population. Other countries, like in Europe and in the U.S. and other democracies, the big concern is how do I protect my citizens from harm in this online environment? And, we as technologists look at this and we say, how do we preserve all of the demonstrated and anticipated value of this online, highly connected, computationally rich environment while we protect everybody, regimes and companies and people, from harmful behaviors that occur across international boundaries, which is another one of the big things. We designed it to be ignorant of international boundaries because it needed to work for the Defense Department everywhere in the world. You don't want to have to go to country X and say, hi, can I get some address space? I'm planning to invade you 2 weeks from now. That doesn't work. So this very difficult challenge now has led some national regimes to adopt the attitude that they need to isolate themselves from the rest of the world somehow to protect themselves. And what they don't understand, of course, is that in the act of isolating themselves, they remove a great deal of value of the connectivity of the net. And second, they make them pretend anyway that if it's in country, somehow it's safer. And all three of us know that that isn't true. No matter where it is, it's potentially attackable in this particular architecture. And so the better thing to do to protect things is not to build these barrier walls, It's to use encryption as a tool for denying access to information except the parties to whom you've been made to give it to.
So going back to the collaboration aspect, I mean, I am a big proponent of the value of open standards built by collaboratively tackling the really hard problems and working to find the right technical solution. And it's my view that we've sort of, you pointed out that things have become, you know, commercially influenced or even proprietary. And you know, I have my point in the history of development that I point out and say that was the moment where we stopped actually solving all the hard problems by really digging in a collaborative, technical, find the right answer fashion. I'm kind of curious if you have a point where you think that happened, and or more importantly, do you think we can get back to solving some of those hard, not just technology, but probably some of the policy problems in that collaborative fashion?
Yes, I do. And I'll give you a worked example of this. Prior to the existence of the internet, there were networks, but they were same brand computers. So IBM had SNA, Digital had DECnet. And those same brand machines could talk to each other through a proprietary network. What happened, though, is with the advent of TCP/IP and the demonstration that different brands of computers could communicate across multiple networks, the customers of networking said, we're not interested in these proprietary designs. We want something that gives me the freedom to buy any computer from anybody and have it work. And so they put pressure on the companies that were offering proprietary networking to make them implement TCP/IP. And the resistance was amazing. I mean, Digital Equipment Corporation and IBM absolutely hated TCP/IP. There were stories about the CEO of DEC asking his board, how do I kill internet? And of course, eventually everybody comes around to realizing that maybe this is not such a bad idea after all. At this point, we have to understand that the emerging properties, some of which are very troublesome, need to be dealt with. I don't believe they can be dealt with purely technically. I've always believed that we only have three kinds of choices in dealing with these problems. One of them is to prevent a harmful behavior technically. If there's a way to make the system reject and resist, that's wonderful. If that doesn't work, then we have to say, okay, we'll try post hoc enforcement. If we catch you doing these things, there'll be consequences. And recognizing, of course, that we won't necessarily catch everybody, just like not everybody who is speeding gets wagged down by a cop. But the point is, if they do catch you, there will be consequences. And then the third thing we can do is to just tell people, don't do that, it's wrong. And I know that sounds wimpy, but I have to remind people that the weakest force in the universe is gravity. And yet when you get a sufficient mass, it has a big impact, keeps the planets in orbit around the sun, keeps the galaxies together. So if you have enough social mass that has adopted a set of norms and behaviors, you can influence personal behavior pretty strongly. So I think those are the three ways in which I believe we have to approach these things. Some of it will require international cooperation. So I've also reached another conclusion that we need accountability and we need agency in this environment. The accountability is for people who are doing harmful things, whether it's people or administrations or companies. And the agency, of course, is providing people and companies and countries with the ability to defend themselves, to operate in a safe way. I believe in the long run, we also need to start teaching people how to think critically about what they see and hear. They have lost, in many cases, the ability to do that. And the reason that's so important is not just on the internet, but in all the other ways in which we learn things. Movies, television, radio, books, magazines, our friends, our parents, our teachers, are all potential sources of bad information, even often, sometimes unintentionally so. And so we need to be thinking like scientists do, which is to say, okay, so where did this information come from? Is there any corroborating evidence? What was the motivation for it? Providing this information to me in the first place. I really want wetware up here to learn how to filter content in a sensible way. And that turns out to be work. And some people may not be willing to do the work. So we still have a long ways to go.
We've talked a lot about, and this podcast about critical thinking and how throughout the years, somehow, some way, you know, we've lost that as an ability to be able to discern fact from fiction, or even look at the provenance of a piece of, you know, data or idea and try to determine whether that is appropriate to believe or not. Now, you mentioned that, you know, there's a couple of levers that we could actually push and that technology isn't the only one, that we should not always rely on technology. At the time that the internet was born, let's say around 1996, although that's not entirely accurate, there was a communications.
That's certainly not how I think of it, because Bob and I were doing this in 1970.
You were at it long before. I know. But for you know, the Communications Decency Act, it is known as, you know, the six letters that gave the internet sort of its walking legs, right? And now there's a lot of debate about whether we ought to reform that act, particularly because of some of the things you mentioned, that there is, you know, such harm like disinformation. I know you and I talked a lot about the impact of disinformation on, you know, elections and ultimately on democratic institutions. So what do you feel that the voices that are asking for the revision of Communications Decency Act, they are right? And if so, if we are going to change it, how should we actually approach changing it so that it is more in line with what we've already learned?
So I don't think that I am terribly in favor of trying to do the kind of censoring that is implied by changing the way in which the Communications Decency Act is intended to work, which is why I mentioned this other alternative, which is accountability and agency. In this case, you mentioned provenance, which I believe is really important. Where did this come from? How do we establish provenance? How can we, can we trust, if we put this in the question form, can we trust the information about where some statement has come from, or some video has come from, or some other thing? And that's made more complicated, partly because you don't have to register to use the internet, although you may have to get an account somewhere. And if you have to pay for the account, it's possible, but at least somebody knows how to reach you. Because they want to ask you to pay if you haven't. And so there are some ways in which we register ourselves just from the business point of view. The other problem that we have more recently is the problem of deep fakes, where we have the ability to generate images and sounds and so on that never actually happened. Now, we all understand that the entertainment industry is eager for those capabilities for obvious reasons. It allows them to create scenes that never could have happened before, including potentially an actor or an actress who's long since gone, suddenly reappearing in this new digital created mode. So we can't necessarily argue that's a bad thing. That actually sounds like a good thing to me. The unfortunate part is that you can also abuse this same capability and mislead people into thinking that they're seeing something which isn't real. That's not a solved problem, but from the philosophical point of view, finding a way to force provenance that is verifiable would really be very helpful. You know, it's a little bit like what we did in the voting advertising thing, where somebody had to say at the end of the ad, I'm responsible for this ad.
Almost like a digital, like watermark. Is that what you're saying?
Kind of. Yeah, that would not be a bad, if by this we might mean it's a digital signature that validates when and where and how this stuff is generated. The problem with all of those ideas, of course, is that when they're completely fabricated, when they're totally artificial, then you can artificially invent whatever provenance you want. And okay. So some of this is back to critical thinking. You know, what is it, the old, if something sounds too good to be true, it probably isn't. And if something sounds like it doesn't make any sense, it probably doesn't. But how do we create a society in which skepticism, healthy skepticism, is the norm? How do we get people to get comfortable asking, where did this come from?
Right.
And saying, if you won't tell me where it came from, I am less likely to believe it. How do we get to the point where we create a society in which trust is regained? Because right now it seems to be dissipating all over everywhere. Our institutions are less trusted now than they ever have been in the last couple hundred years. How do we rebuild trust in the institutions and the system? And I wish I had a magic wand to do like Harry Potter, but I don't. And so now we have to get help figuring out how to create that verifiable environment again.
Standing at this point in time, what are the technologies upcoming about which you're excited about the prospects?
Well, there are a number of them. I will say that the public key crypto digital signature ideas are very attractive. They have a lot of potential for provenance, for example. We also know that quantum computing has the potential to undermine the existing algorithms, but thank God for the National Institutes of Standards and Technology, they now have three candidate algorithms that are not subject to attack by a successful Shor's algorithm on a quantum computer. Just going down the quantum side for 1 second, that has huge potential value in solving optimization problems in real time that we would otherwise not even begin to tackle. It's a little bit like what happened with spreadsheets. If you remember when desktop machines were produced, like the Apple II or the Apple II Plus, one of the first successful applications was VisiCalc, which is a spreadsheet. And the thing that made it so valuable was that it was almost instantaneous. So you could explore the implications of the spreadsheet that you had coded to see what would happen if you changed these various variables. You could explore in real time what the consequences were. Quantum computing may give us that capability in extremely complex and computationally hard spaces. So I'm excited about those technologies. I'm also excited about the possibility that we finally wake up and realize that as we are focusing on technical development, we should also have at the table psychologists and sociologists and neuroscientists and anthropologists who can tell us more about how these technologies will affect people and how do we keep them safer and how do we make them healthily skeptical so that they can defend themselves against abusive behaviors.
Truly, truly a sage you are, Vint, because that's, I think, very profound. Humans interact with technology and we have our own foibles, biases, you know, cognitive impairments and all of that. And so what you are envisioning when you're writing requirements or envisioning the ultimate product may not always work out the way because, you know, human beings are involved in using it.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
There goes all your plans.
Well, that's why we still enjoy Shakespeare's plays, because people haven't changed in the last 400 years. And so all of our foibles are amply illustrated in those plays. I will say, though, that I want people to feel not only enabled, but also, let me use a strong word, compelled to exercise their critical thinking more than we have tended to do. Somehow, we need to make it a reward or a mark of esteem if you're capable of thinking your way through and exposing misinformation and disinformation. How do we make people want to do that as opposed to falling into the confirmation bias trap because it's comfortable?
Yes.
And I don't know how you design a society in which we elevate that capability and have great respect for it, as opposed to the kind of divisive polarization that we see today, where you know the other guy must be stupid and clearly doesn't understand anything because he or she believes this, and the other side, of course, goes the other way. Somehow. We need to, I think, infuse into our society more respect for people who can think and are willing to take the time and trouble to think. We need to give them tools for provenance that you mentioned earlier. And so how do we create an environment, or what's the other word for this, ecosystem? How do we create an ecosystem in which it's feasible to identify the origins of content? I will say that a lot of people will respond positively if you show them how they could be fooled. No one wants to be fooled when you get right down. Nobody wants to be made a fool. And so if you can make it a constructive experience to see how you could be fooled and how other people have been fooled, you might allow people to, first of all, feel like they're not alone. And second, they don't have to admit they were stupid.
Right.
That's one of the reasons these collisions occur, is because somebody who believes they have all the facts will say, if you just had all the facts, you'd agree with me. And the other side, who may have swallowed some fiction, has problems accepting the idea that those are facts and he or she accepted fictions, because then you have to admit you were stupid.
That's right.
Or fooled. And a lot of people resist that, and then they double down on their misbelief.
Well, we've covered a lot of ground today, and a lot of very fascinating ground. And it's you know, good to look towards the future with some level of optimism of new and exciting things coming. Any parting words you'd like to share with our audience?
Well, two things. First of all, and maybe more than two, but first of all, there is an interplanetary internet coming. We've been working on it since 1998. I'm super excited about where we are. It's been standardized in the IETF, standardized in the Consultative Committee on Space Data Systems. It's being anticipated for use in the return to the moon and the Artemis and Gateway missions and the other related similar missions in ESA and JAXA and CARI, as well as NASA. So that's hugely exciting. The team that's been working on it since 1998 is pumping hard. So that's one thing. The second thing is that I'm seeing just astonishing capacity in the machine learning world to absorb a lot of content and to try to make sense out of it. We also see that it's brittle. We can see how it can fail. We understand that we have to be careful not to train with biased information or with bad quality information. But we're seeing an age of computational X for so many different values of X. I get very excited about that, because this is an empowering tool. That it's not just artificial intelligence and machine learning, but it's raw computation. Recently, a lot of the data that NASA had collected was re-examined using some very powerful and new technologies to find additional asteroids that might potentially threaten our planet. And I think that the re-examination of already collected data netted about 104 asteroids we didn't know about. And so when you think about the planetary consequences of a collision with a large asteroid,
ask the dinosaurs.
Yeah, we're going to be looking at the sky a different way now. 100, you said 104? Wow.
And that's just the beginning. So I see a period of time when our computational tools, not just in technical terms, but there's computational linguistics, there's computational humanities, something I enjoy talking about, where we take the tools of computation and we turn them to look at text analysis, for example, or can we discover a new Shakespeare play that was, and can we validate that it was likely Shakespeare as opposed to somebody pretending? But all those tools are starting to emerge, and they're becoming cost-effective and easily attained, whether it's in the cloud or in a laptop or your mobile. So for me, this is the age of computation is really getting exciting.
Well, it's been a delight to have you. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you for the invitation. I hope that we'll get a chance to chat some more about other things that are coming, and maybe some things that not one of us knows about until, you know, it shows up, which is that wonderful quote that the future is already here, but it's not uniformly distributed.
Correct.
There you go.
Thank you so much, Bent. I saw your appearance on Colbert, And I have to say, that was so good. You were very good. I don't know how somebody would have managed someone like him, because he just comes out of left field. But you were excellent. I think you might have left him with a few better understanding of how things might work.
Well, first of all, we had a nice chat before the show, not about the show. He's a very smart guy. He's all into computing. He designed a multi-user text editing system before, Google Docs.
Wow.
He needed it because the people who were writing the jokes all needed to be working together concurrently. So he just, put one together.
Good idea.
As one does.
The other thing which was very amusing about that session is that the producer came and said, okay, you're not allowed to tell any jokes. You're the straight man, and Stephen is the guy that cracks the jokes. And so after we finished the first segment, and they went on to commercial break, he said, can we do another segment? And I said, well, sure. And so the first thing he puts up is a picture of me and a picture of the guy that plays the architect in The Matrix.
And I
look at that and I'm sitting here thinking, I know what the producer said, but you know what? That's a gimme. I'm not going to pass that one up. So my question for Stephen was, what makes you think you're not in The Matrix?
Yes, that was so good. That was so good. And I have to say, whoever was that on Matrix, I didn't realize that until that clip from Colbert. And I was like, oh my God, that does look like Vin. Down to how, the sartorial perfection.
Creepy suit, beard.
Creepy suit, the whole bit. That is why I think People Magazine said you were one of the most intriguing people of a particular year.
Well, that was 1994. It was People Magazine. I think that was before the Matrix series.
Oh, yeah.
I have to tell you, there's a little family issue about that issue, that particular issue of People Magazine. I got one page, right? 4 years later, my wife got 6 pages in People magazine, and she doesn't have a PR agency or anything else.
How'd that come about?
She lost her hearing when she was 3 years old. She had spinal meningitis. And so for 50 years, she had to lip read. That's all the only way she could communicate, which is really hard, doesn't work with everybody. It's very stressful. She went through school, raised 2 kids, the whole thing in silence. And then, and her speech was normal because she'd acquired speech by age 3. So her speech actually sounded okay. She just couldn't hear. And then in 1996, she got her first cochlear implant, which worked spectacularly well. I mean, just unbelievable. Back into the hearing world. And so People magazine heard about that, and they sent a crew out, and they followed her around for a week, taking all kinds of pictures. And she got a 6-page story out of that. And the gal that wrote the story said it was the story that she liked writing more than any that she'd ever written.
So she's got a couple of pages up in People magazine up ahead of you.
That's right.
All right. Wow. Vint, it's always a pleasure. Thank you so much. And we'd love to have you back, by the way, whenever you have time.
You just get on the calendar. You need to talk to my chief of staff, and I'm sure she'll be accommodating. And it's always fun to talk to both of you. So I look forward to another go around.
Thank you.
Bye.
Okay. See you on the net.
Thank you.
Indeed.
Thanks for listening to this TechSequences podcast. We are Leslie Daigle and Alexa Rod. You can reach us by email, techsequences@techsequences.org. We'd love to hear from you to know what you thought about this episode or ideas for future episodes. TechSequences. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook and subscribe through your favorite podcasting service.